This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
In some of the world's driest places, people are harvesting water from thin air using giant nets to trap fog. Research from Chile has found that this method could meet an entire city's water demands. I'm Hannah Gelbart. Join me on What in the World to hear how fog catching works and if it could help solve global water shortages. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We cover news and trending topics every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the programme. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service and we're coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. The Israeli Prime Minister has accused Hamas of murdering two Israeli children in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu also said the militants would pay for returning a body that was not the children's mother, something Hamas blamed on a mix-up. It has said in the past couple of hours that it's now handed over her body to the Red Cross. Israel has not yet confirmed that. Israel says that its analysis of the remains of the two boys showed they had been murdered at the hands of Hamas, while the group maintains they and their mother, whose name was Shiri Bibas, were killed early on in the war in an Israeli airstrike. Mr. Netanyahu said he would not rest until Hamas was destroyed.
Who kidnaps a little boy and a baby and murders them? Monsters, that's who. These Hamas monsters also cynically refused to bring back the boy's mother, Shiri, and sent the body of a Gazan woman instead, in brazen violation of the agreement. Today, the heavens shake. The entire civilized world should condemn these horrific murders. The entire civilized world should join Israel in demanding the immediate release of all the hostages. All of Israel is united in grief. And as the Prime Minister of Israel, I vow that I will not rest until the savages who executed our hostages are brought to justice. They do not deserve to walk this earth. Nothing will stop me. Nothing.
Well, we tried to get a response from a current member of Hamas. We weren't able to do so. We did, however, speak to Ahmed Youssef, who was a senior advisor to the former Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, and is now in a camp for displaced people in Khan Yunis in Gaza. He said Hamas was investigating the Israeli claims and that it hadn't intended to disrupt the ceasefire agreement.
I believe that nobody from Hamas side, I don't think they are trying to play games. They would like to continue the truce and they would like to be trustworthy in the way they are handling the agreement that they have negotiated in Qatar and Egypt.
Well, in a minute, we'll hear from the father of a man who was one of the hostages, the Israeli hostages released last weekend. First, here's our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, on where these developments leave the ceasefire negotiations.
That ceasefire, which came into effect on January the 19th, is the first phase of a three-phase deal. It comes to an end on March the 1st. It's been was described as the humanitarian phase, although today, hearing of all this sorrow and cruelty, it doesn't feel like a very humane day. But yeah, there are still more hostages to be released as part of this six-week phase, which comes to an end, and then begins the second phase. Now, negotiations on the second phase of the ceasefire, which is much more demanding for both sides. Hamas must give up all the remaining prisoners, which are mainly soldiers. Yeah. And Israel, which had in the first phase pulled back its troops from populated areas of the Gaza Strip, must pull out completely. In other words, the end of the war. And Prime Minister Netanyahu and his key allies always said from the beginning, they saw this as a temporary ceasefire. They didn't want to see the end of the war. They've been looking at those, for Israel, deeply, deeply infuriating images of Hamas taking political advantage from the return of the hostages and seeing this show of strength in realizing that Hamas is not destroyed. A complete military victory over a weakened Hamas is simply not possible. But we're hearing again today this profound pain of the hostage families saying every minute longer that the hostages are in Gaza is a minute too long. You must keep the ceasefire going. You must bring everyone home.
That was our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Over the past 16 months, we've spoken several times to Jonathan Dekel Chen, whose son, Sagi, was held hostage by Hamas for nearly 500 days. Well, last Saturday, Sagi was freed as part of the ceasefire deal. I spoke to Jonathan again today and I asked him how his son was doing.
All things considered, he's doing okay. He sustained wounds on October 7th, 2023, during the Hamas massacre in our home, Kibbutz Nir Oz. And on top of that, he, like all of the other hostages, after 500 days of no sunlight, malnutrition, very little to no medical care, horrific sanitary conditions, and the threat of death hovering above their heads every moment, alongside all of those very, very, very difficult and impossible conditions, he is doing okay, a testament to his strength and to his faith.
He had no idea, did he, whether his wife and two daughters were alive, or indeed that he had another child.
That's correct. Sagi and all of the hostages who have been released from the Hamas tunnel network were in an information vacuum, so that Sagi only learned that his wife and two older daughters survived. He sort of pieced together some information in the 2 days before he was freed, and he only learned of the birth of his third daughter after he crossed the border into Israel and was informed about it by an IDF officer who received him.
Is he talking freely about conditions in those tunnels, or is it something that he's comfortable communicating about?
He is comfortable, but you know, nearly 500 days is an awfully long time. So it's going to be an ongoing process of him describing what he has experienced. Also, because he wants to hear in the time that we're together that he's not undergoing medical care. He wants to hear about what's transpired in the rest of the world. We are hearing about the horrors, true horrors of, if you can call it, life for the hostages in the hellhole tunnels of Gaza. He is learning, of course, about some happy things. His daughter, of course, who was born, but also the murder of some of his best friends on Nir Oz and our kibbutz on October 7th, who were murdered in cold blood alongside their children, you know, their parents. And so it's been a kind of rough rebirth for him in that regard. There's very little good news from our home following the massacre.
And what about the rest of the family in this past week, including you? What's it been like?
Well, it's to see my beloved son emerge from the valley of death. We really didn't know if he was still alive. The Red Cross and the Red Crescent were never allowed to this day to visit with the hostages. So we never really knew, nor did we know what condition he would emerge in. If you recall, the Saturday before Sagi and two other hostages were released, there was a release of three adult men who, for lack of a better term, looked like Holocaust survivors, you know, after a death march. So we simply didn't know what to expect. We are absolutely overjoyed as a family. But in these days, everything is a mixed bag. Because we are from this one community, Kibbutz Nir Oz, we also experienced over the last couple of days the sadness and then the horror around the return of four bodies, all of them from our home. And get the news this morning that Shiri Bibas, Hamas, put a different body into that coffin. So it's all very traumatic for us. But we are trying to embrace as much as possible the joy around Sagi coming back to us.
What are you making of that bitter row over the release of those hostages' bodies, or non-release, as the case may be?
I really don't know what to make of it. You know, that's for the negotiators to figure out what's going on here.
But it doesn't make you want to shut down the ceasefire process.
Absolutely not. The family itself, the Bibas family itself, has made a clear statement that they are not seeking revenge, rather completion of the hostage deal. I don't think you'll find anyone, you know, with a bit of sanity in Israel who would want to torpedo the release process now on the basis of what happened today. Hamas, of course, must transfer Shiri's, if she's indeed deceased, transfer her body and no one else's. But that's an issue. It's a technical issue that must be solved with the help of the negotiators and not blowing up this hostage release, because it serves everyone, Israelis and Palestinians, to end this war. The only way that happens is by completing this hostage deal.
And when you hear the Prime Minister say that Hamas must pay the price for a cruel and evil violation of the ceasefire agreement, how do you react?
look, there's a lot of noise all around. I try to step back. I also know this as a professional historian. If you follow the noise, you can get lost. And what we have all seen is that despite the noise since, you know, the first round of exchange, the exchange has gone according to plan. So I try not to get sort of carried away on that roller coaster of, you know, accusations, counter accusations and threats, and just look at the results. Hamas has to produce. They must produce tomorrow, obviously, the six hostages, living hostages that they committed to. We hope that they are in decent condition, and they must fulfill into the letter all of the points of this agreement, including returning Shiri Bibas. Whether or not she's alive or has been murdered, we have no idea.
Your friend, the peace activist Oded Lifshitz, who was 84, was taken alive by Hamas, but he died in captivity. His body was returned on Thursday. Tell us about him, would you?
Yes, it's difficult because it's so painful. Oded was one of the founders of our kibbutz. He was a man of ideological commitments to peace, on the one hand, to the security of Israel, on the other, and a deep humanity about him in his retirement. He and his wife, who was kidnapped but thankfully released very early on, they had been very active in the peace movement. He'd committed most of his life to it, and in his retirement years, he made a habit of transporting ill Palestinians, mostly kids, from border crossings into Israel, into our hospitals, to get them treatment that they couldn't receive inside of Gaza. To see a man like that, of just true values, and a man of peace, as all of us are along the border, to die in that way. He was alive for months in captivity, and he died. How exactly he died, I cannot say, but he died as a direct result of his captivity by Hamas. It's infuriating. It's unspeakably sad. But we need to keep moving forward with this agreement.
Are you optimistic, finally, that the ceasefire will hold?
I have to believe that it will. It serves no one other than, you know, fringe ideologues to blow this up. I have faith in certainly the U.S. negotiators and the Trump team, in essence, that they're absolutely committed to getting this done. And they have intervened a number of times since he was elected in the process in order to make sure that it continues to go forward. It's not easy for Israel, you know, making a deal with Satan. The Palestinians aren't Satan. Hamas is Satan. And making a deal with them is extremely difficult. It requires a great deal of internal strength to be able to do that. I want to believe that my own government, the Israeli government, will summon the courage to do that, understanding that, yes, there are risks, but the rewards of getting all of our people back, still 70 hostages being held, outweigh the risks of completing this deal.
Jonathan Dekel Chen, the Israeli Defense Forces have said they're looking into reports that Hamas has handed over the body of the hostage Shiri Bibas to the Red Cross on Friday evening. BBC World Service, this is NewsHour. Coming up, how experimental gene therapy was used to treat a little boy's blindness.
I opened the window and the light shone through really bright and he squinted and he kind of pulled himself back. It wasn't just even an eye shut. It was kind of a physical reaction. And I remember welling up and getting really emotional because that was the first time that Jace ever had any reaction to any sort of light stimulus.
Our top stories this hour. President Trump has sharply criticized the leaders of Britain and France, saying they'd done nothing to end the war in Ukraine. He also added he was sick of Ukraine's president. The Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has said her government's considering seeking the repatriation of Ismael El Mayo, a suspected drug lord who could face the death sentence in the United States. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC. A word now from the boss of the tech giant Apple.
Today, we're excited to complete the iPhone 16 family with a new model that features the performance, intelligence, and privacy you expect. And here it is.
Tim Cook was promoting the new Apple iPhone out at the end of this month. Let's consider, though, that word privacy, because Apple is taking an unprecedented step of removing its highest level data security tool from customers here in the UK after the government demanded access to user data. Advanced Data Protection, or ADP, means only account holders can view items such as photos and documents they've stored online through a process known as end-to-end encryption. But the British authorities have asked for the right to see the data, which currently not even Apple can access. How unusual is this? Lily Jamali is the BBC's North America technology correspondent.
It's unusual. There really aren't many precedents that we can look to for what Apple is doing here. It's an extreme measure, and it's aimed, one would presume, at motivating the UK to back down from the request that you just laid out there. From the UK government's perspective, they're not commenting, by the way, on what they're demanding from Apple. But according to our reporting and reporting from the Washington Post, it's a demand for access to encrypted media of Apple users in the UK, but also of users all around the world. So it's quite a sweeping request. And proponents say that, yes, you know, it will help investigators probe potential crimes, serious crimes like terrorism or child sexual abuse. In fact, here in the U.S., the FBI made a very specific request of Apple back in 2015 regarding a particular case involving a mass shooting. Apple said no then on privacy grounds. And this is all about pushing back against the creation of any kind of backdoor to Apple's devices, to encrypted material. Privacy advocates say doing that would really be a slippery slope.
And are the UK authorities out on a limb in making this request?
I think certainly if you ask people here in Silicon Valley, they would say absolutely they are. This is a broad request that affects, basically every Apple user around the world if they were to grant the UK what's desired here. It might be the UK today, they would say, but it could be an authoritarian government asking for this very same privilege tomorrow. And that's not a situation that Apple certainly wants to be in. This is a company, as you heard just there with that soundbite that you played from Tim Cook, that puts privacy front and center in the way that it markets itself to customers. And I think customers have really heard that message from them. That's part of why people choose to spend extra on Apple devices compared to some of the competitors. But the company's really been thrust into this debate, into a national security debate, a privacy debate. And in fact, here in the U.S., there are some top lawmakers who are weighing in on what the U.K. is asking for, saying that it's a threat to American national security, actually, so much so that they're suggesting there should be a reconsideration of the relationship, that intelligence sharing relationship between the U.K. and the U.S. So the stakes are incredibly high here.
And just briefly, do we know how many U.K. users actually opt in to use this service? Is it a huge thing?
We don't actually have those numbers, but you're absolutely right that it is an opt-in service. So for those who have it, they won't be able to access it forever. And if you don't already have it, you won't be able to sign up at this point.
Lily Jamali, the BBC's North America technology correspondent, she was speaking to me from San Francisco. Now, for more than a decade, West Africa has been in the grip of an opioid crisis. Thousands of lives have been ruined by illegal pills packaged as medicines and sold on the streets. Up until now, no one has exposed the pharmaceutical executives behind this deadly trade. Our investigations unit, BBCI, has been probing the companies that are making and shipping these pills and the people profiting from addiction. Yasser Masahudu reports.
Here in my hometown of Tamale in northern Ghana, illegal opioids are destroying young lives. The problem has become so bad, locals have set up a task force to stop the dealers.
We have to try all our best as a community to see the best we can do. That is what we are doing.
Bikoko runs a local bakery. He is also one of the task force leaders.
Let's go.
Today, they've had a tip-off. We are heading to one of the poorest neighborhoods in Tamale.
Let's go.
Okay. What is happening right now is the task force is here to arrest the drug dealers.
I don't know anything.
I don't feel that.
You see how you disgrace yourself to this low? Look at kids are watching you. So you want to destroy people's children.
As we pass through the tight streets, you see addicts who are clearly under the effects of these addictive and highly dangerous drugs. Some take them as painkillers, some to help them get through hard physical work, but many use them simply to get high.
This place is being invaded by the drug peddlers. So that's why we're here this afternoon, to see their source of where they are getting the drugs.
The task force detains several men and seizes hundreds of opioid pills. I'm told that this is an almost daily occurrence. So where are the pills coming from? All we have to go on are clues on the packets seized. A made in India stamp, and in the corner, a logo, an A with a leaf at the bottom. It's the same logo turning up on opioid pills on the streets of Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, and Nigeria. Pills that are a particularly dangerous combination of opioid and muscle relaxant. We tracked the manufacturer back to India and a company called Aveo Pharmaceuticals. An undercover operative agreed to go inside a Aveo's factory, posing as a businessman looking to supply opioids to Nigeria.
Hello ladies, we're here to see Mr. Sharma.
Vinod Sharma is one of the directors of Aveo. He manages his factory outside Mumbai.
So nice to see you.
After giving them a tour of the factory, they sit down to talk business.
I can clear from our custom. You can clear from your side. Every client working like this, tablet is very powerful. Suppose you can use the two or three tablets in the one time, you can like this relax. Yeah.
This is what the kids like. That's what they like. You said that high.
This is very harmful for the health. But customer cannot understand. Now that this is a business.
It's business, yeah.
In India, any drug made only for export must comply with the requirements of the importing country. Ghana's drug authority told us this product does not meet their import requirements. By shipping these drugs to Ghana, Aveo is breaking Indian law. Back in Tamale, it's left for groups like the Citizens Task Force to tackle the opioid crisis. That evening, they gather in the local park to ban the drugs. But as they ban, production lines in India churn out millions more, driving a public health crisis across the whole of West Africa. We put these allegations to Vinod Sharma and Aveo Pharmaceuticals. They did not respond. The Indian drugs regulator, the CDSCO, told us India recognizes its responsibility towards global public health. It said the country's drug regulatory system is strong and strict action will be taken against any pharmaceutical firm involved in malpractice. It called upon importing countries to support India's efforts by enforcing similarly strong regulations. Yahya Masaudu, BBC News.
That report from Ghana, you can read more about that story on the BBC website by searching for BBC I Investigations. You're with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're live from London.
Some of the world's driest places, people are harvesting water from thin air using giant nets to trap fog. Research from Chile has found that this method could meet an entire city's water demands. I'm Hannah Gelbart. Join me on What in the World to hear how fog catching works and if it could help solve global water shortages. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We cover news and trending topics every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, surgeons in London have become the first to preserve the sight of young children born with a rare genetic condition. Details of a study published in the Lancet Medical Journal explain how the vision of four patients was restored through the use of experimental gene therapy. Jace, now 6 years old, was diagnosed with a condition that weakened his retinas when he was a baby. He was treated at Moorfields Hospital here in London, and he's now able to recognise objects a few metres away. His father, Brendan, described the moment when the treatment began to have an effect.
It was the morning. I took Jace down to our living room. At the time, we had a big back bay window, and it was a sunny day. And I was holding him. He was still an infant or baby at that point to me. And I opened the window, and the light shone through really bright, and he squinted. And he kind of pulled himself back. It wasn't just even an eye shut. It was kind of a physical reaction. And I remember welling up and getting really emotional, because that was the first time that Jace ever had any reaction to any sort of light stimulus or anything of the sort.
One of the study's authors is Professor James Bainbridge, a retinal surgeon from University College London and Moorfields Eye Hospital. He's been speaking to this programme's Tim Franks.
We were delighted to see that the new treatment could improve their sight really remarkably, not just preserve the sight because they had very little to start with, but actually to improve it. The aim is to provide the cells in the retina with the gene that's otherwise lacking. Healthy copies of this gene can be generated in the laboratory, packaged in a disabled virus, and injected directly into the retina. And the virus delivers the gene into the cells that need that gene in order to provide the protein that's critical to kickstart, if you like, the function of the retina and indeed the normal eyesight. So that's how it's done. And the injection of the suspension of genes is done during surgery, which lasts approximately 1 hour to do. So within a month or two, the parents of these young kids were describing notable improvements.
And was this therapy performed in both eyes or just one eye?
So in the first instance, we injected just one eye because we were unsure about the safety and so wanted to protect the kids against harm from side effects. Having established the treatment in those four children, others have gone on to have injections in both eyes.
Right. And, I mean, what sort of effects are the parents reporting?
It's been really remarkable. The children who would otherwise be expected to have really no sight at all can run around safely without bumping into things. They can recognise faces, recognise shapes, see their toys. They can reach for small objects on the toys. They can interact socially much more comfortably. And so it's had an amazing effect on their general development.
One of the other things that's often said about gene therapy is that it's quite expensive and perhaps difficult to scale. Can you tell me how sort of far you think this type of therapy may be extended and also perhaps to other types of sight loss as well?
The expense is a real challenge, but I think the first thing to say is that it's hard to price the value of eyesight. Secondly, I think the technology is an early stage, and so it's very likely that with further development it can become more manageable, more feasible to manufacture more cheaply.
Professor James Bainbridge from UCL and Moorfields Eye Hospital here in London. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. German elections take place on Sunday following the collapse late last year of the country's governing centre-left coalition. There's a complicated backdrop to this vote as Europe's biggest economy remains in recession and as its role as the continent's chief financier of Ukraine's fight against Russia is called into question. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy is in Berlin.
The Trump factor has added some spice and unpredictability to an election campaign that is still expected to end with the 69-year-old Friedrich Merz from the centre-right Christian Democrats, or CDU, becoming the next German Chancellor after Sunday's vote. But the size and the complexion of any coalition he'll lead is still uncertain, as is the relationship the next Chancellor will have with Washington. Today, Mr. Merz told an interviewer that Europe had to prepare for Donald Trump no longer upholding NATO's mutual defence agreement. He also wondered whether the United States could slide into an authoritarian populist system. Although he too has been accused of pandering to populists after he relied on votes from the far right or radical right AFD, that's the Elon Musk endorsed party that is second in the opinion polls, to pass what was a non-binding parliamentary motion tightening Germany's borders. Now, that earned him a bit of a slap on the wrist for Angela Merkel, the former chancellor who famously opened Germany's borders to more than a million refugees 10 years ago. A lot, though, has changed since then. And here in Berlin, I've been hearing about different sides of the complicated immigration experience, beginning with one of the Syrians who came to Germany in the 2015 Merkel wave.
Well, this is a rather charming Syrian restaurant in the Schönberg district, and you can probably hear preparations in full swing for tonight's customers who are being treated to
lovely starters like tabouleh fattoush. Now, we're very excited to meet the owner of this place. Her name's Malakeh Jasmati. She's one of the Syrians who came to Germany a decade ago, and she's made a real success of things.
As a refugee, I leave my Damascus, and it's not easy to leave your homeland, because homeland, it's like mother. When I come to here, start cooking for my friends. Step by step, I surprised now to cook for Angela Merkel. She asked me about the food. She asked me about the recipe of shawarma, because she fell in love with my shawarma.
How do you think of Germany? You say that your mother is Damascus, but how do you think of Germany?
She's my friend, my close friend. When you will close your eyes and think about your close friend, you will be emotional and happy. That's it's my emotion with Berlin.
Now, what would you say then to people who are looking at what's happening in Germany at the moment and say, look, this party on the far right, the AfD, is doing very well. The CDU is also being more tough on immigration, and we'll look at Germany and wonder if it's still a welcoming country, it's still a good country for people to come to. What would you say?
As a refugee, you need to be hard worker. I have a lot of conversation with AfD people. Start to talk about, did you pay your taxes? I told him, maybe more than you. Did you let your children go to school and learn German? I told him, for sure. They know about Christmas. Listen, I'm Muslim, but my grandmother, she's Christian. And after that, he said, I don't have a problem with the example like you. What do you mean? Syrian people, they helping you. How many doctors, Syrian doctors we have? Did you imagine if those doctors come back to Syria, what it's happened? Da-da-da-da. Don't judge us. You need us.
Hello, you're live with BBC News. I'm Anna Foster here in the German city of Magdeburg, a city in shock this afternoon after five...
But it's the recent spate of attacks by asylum seekers and immigrants, not the work of Syrian doctors or chefs, that explains why immigration has been at the top of German voters' minds, as well as where the attacks are happening, according to Susan Fratzke from the Migration Policy Institute.
Even if there's a low risk of being the victim of an attack that's committed by a migrant, if you tell someone that, that won't necessarily change their perception of that threat. And that's particularly true for the types of crimes that we've seen recently in Germany, which have been really, you know, highly visible and dramatic crimes, like the attack that we saw on the Christmas market in Magdeburg. And in Germany, I think these types of visible events have been particularly salient for people because of how important public gatherings and these types of festivals are.
We have it's security glass.
Although it's smashed up there.
Here somebody tried to throw the fire inside. There were two people inside and they couldn't come out because somebody locked the door from outside. So people would have died here inside. They also wrote...
In the Neukölln district of Berlin, the local integration officer, Gunnar Balci, shows me the site of a less well-known but potentially deadly attack on a cafe bar that's taken a strong stand against anti-Semitism and homophobia.
Well, Neukölln is one of the poorest and also one of the biggest districts we have in Berlin. And in the last years, we had a lot of people coming here from Syria and Iran, Iraq. We really have a problem by finding apartments, flats for the people who come here in the last years. Sometimes it's not really easy to find a school place. We have a large number of, I call them reactionary mosques. And these mosques, they also offer Quran lessons, and they are very successful in spreading their ideology into the minds of kids. And a lot of what kids learn there is really against democratic values.
So when political parties say, look, these new arrivals could be a danger to German society, are they right?
Well, the new arrivals are not the danger for the German society. It is how we handle them. people see what happens in their neighborhoods.
They see what happened here.
They see what happens here, and they realize that there are problems that the Democratic parties were not able to talk about because they never wanted to be called racist. But it's not racism to talk about problems and to try to solve them.
That was Gunnar Balci. This evening, people are wondering in this city whether there's been another incident of this kind. News this evening that not far from here, just at the city's Holocaust Memorial, a man was stabbed. We understand now he was a 30-year-old Spanish tourist. It's also understood that the suspected perpetrator has been arrested. No one knows his identity just yet, but this will only add to the tensions in this city ahead of Sunday's election.
James Kumarasamy will continue to report from Berlin. The Trump administration says it will end the right to remain in the US granted to Haitian refugees by the last government. More than 500,000 citizens of Haiti and the Caribbean will now be obliged to return home in August because an extension to their visas due to war, natural disasters or other extraordinary circumstances is no longer deemed valid. During his election campaign, Mr. Trump famously tried to stigmatize Haitian immigrants in Ohio by claiming falsely that they were eating people's pets. Let's hear from a Haitian woman who's been living and working in the US for more than 5 years with a 5-year-old daughter. She is unsure where they'll be living in 6 months' time. She asked us not to use her name.
As all of the TPS holder, the fate is already set. If we don't have other possibility to go in another country, we have to go back in Haiti. More than 500,000 of person in danger of deportation, losing their job, losing their access to all the benefit that they have under the TPS. It is super scary because my daughter is facing several health issues. This is one of my reasons to stay there. The school here in the US started August. So we are facing also uncertainty as to whether our kids will be able to start a new school year or going back in Haiti, where the school system is not working properly because as the gang is taking away, everything is under gang control in Haiti. As a community, we have to fight together because it is arbitrary and putting at risk 500,000 of people. And we are part of the workforce of the U.S. We are paying taxes. I wanted to tell my community to keep it strong, and together we're going to fight this issue.
One Haitian immigrant to the US, the BBC's Central America correspondent Will Grant, has reported from both Washington and Haiti in recent years. He explained to me first why some people would be concerned for their safety if they had to return to Haiti.
Well, it remains the case, Paul, that 85% of the capital, Port-au-Prince, remains under gang control. That statistic hasn't changed despite the deployment of hundreds of Kenyan police officers leading a sort of international security force. There have been some minor improvements here, there, and around the capital in terms of security, but nothing that we could say would be a genuine shift in the security situation. That meant last year more than 5,600 people in Haiti were killed through gang violence. You know, the security situation alone would be enough, but we have to add on to that the humanitarian crisis, which is also there, a borderline famine situation that I saw last time I was in Haiti, and real food insecurity for millions of families.
Presumably, Donald Trump thinks it will be popular among his base to send them home.
And I think he's probably right in that assessment. I mean, this is part of what he's talked about being the mass deportation that he promised to his base. We should add that as well as removing the TPS status, the temporary protected status, to 500,000 Haitians, this was also removed to around 600,000 Venezuelans at the end of last month, all part of this push essentially to make it far harder to remain in the United States under temporary measures, far harder to gain asylum hearings if you're making it to the US southern border, for example, and essentially make the situation a lot harder in terms of a crackdown on people living without documents or with very, very temporary protected situations like the ones extended to Haitians and Venezuelans.
Is this final for Haitians in the US? Can they appeal?
Currently, it looks like all sorts of appeals would fall on deaf ears. Of course, there are migrant rights organisations who will be challenging this in the courts. And there are lobbyists and some extremely influential ones in terms of Venezuela as well. We can just think about the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio's personal sympathies towards situations like that in Venezuela and Cuba. He's the son of Cuban migrants who left the Castro government. So, you know, we know that he is sympathetic towards those looking to make it to the United States from those nations. Nevertheless, I think what wins that argument in terms of the Trump administration is the fact that they want this mass deportation. They want to be hard. They want to be saying no to people. So I think that it will be extremely difficult to reverse this, given the justice system is increasingly conservative in the United States.
The BBC Central America correspondent Will Grant, you're with the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, Donald Trump has said that he does not consider it essential for the Ukrainian president to be there at negotiations aimed at ending Russia's war in Ukraine. The US president said Mr. Zelensky had been there for 3 years and that he'd made it very hard to make deals. Kyiv and Europe have complained of having been sidelined after Mr. Trump opened talks with Moscow over the war it began in 2022. He's called Mr. Zelensky a dictator. He has falsely accused him of starting the war. Today, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the details of a new meeting were yet to be worked out. He was speaking to reporters during a media briefing by phone.
So far, there are no specifics about the meeting between Putin and Trump. There is an understanding of the need for this meeting, which was stated during the meeting of the Russian and American delegations in Riyadh. There is a wish of the two presidents, which they have expressed. And there is an attitude to prepare this meeting well so that it would be as effective as possible. During the preparation, all the nuances will be discussed.
Well, the White House National Security Advisor Mike Waltz said he expected Mr. Zelensky to cede to US pressure and sign a deal with the United States on Ukraine's reserves of valuable minerals. He said that would happen soon. He was speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington today.
President Zelensky is going to sign that deal. And you will see that in the very short term. And that is good for Ukraine. What better could you have for Ukraine than to be in an economic partnership with the United States, number one? What better could you have for Ukraine to stop the killing, number two? And you know what? We have an obligation to you all, the American taxpayer, to recoup the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been invested in this war.
Mike Waltz, the White House National Security Advisor. Mykhailo Podolyok is a senior aide to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. When Julian Waraka spoke to him for our sister program Weekend, he asked him first for his assessment of the Ukrainian President's mood after what's been said this week in Washington.
For the President of Ukraine, there is a stable position that he adheres to. This position requires a working and fighting mood because we need to continue resolving the issues of war and peace. But of course, we are surprised by the position taken by the 47th American president today. It is a bit strange because we see his aggressive rhetoric towards Europe and Ukraine and his much less justified rhetoric towards the Russian Federation.
Surprise, because you're talking about an ally, at least until a week or so ago, whose leader is now calling your leader a dictator with only 4% support.
We're surprised by his position generally, because it's not rational towards the Russian Federation. Today's claims that we hear from the US are definitely seen by the Russian Federation as a means to increase the expansion of their territory in Ukraine. This is surprising for us because this is not the way towards peace. We don't quite understand yet why this administration is making these claims. The only aggressor here is clearly the man who is the head of the Russian Federation, Putin. These claims are definitely unfair. President Zelensky gives correct assessments of the claims from the United States that we are hearing.
But the point must surely be that he can't carry on doing what he's been doing for the last 3 years because everything around him has changed so dramatically.
The president of Ukraine is looking for solutions, and we are continuing to cooperate with the Americans so that some of our weapons and some of our finances come from the United States. I understand why the U.S. administration are making such strange claims today. They feel triumphant, returning to the White House, and they have the impression that they can quickly finish lots of processes if they put pressure on certain countries. But to my mind, the pressure has to be put not on Ukraine, but exclusively on the Russian Federation.
Can I ask about one specific American demand, namely that Ukraine signs a deal to allow American access to at least some of the country's minerals? Is the president open to looking at that?
Let's be clear here. This initiative came from Ukraine. We are prepared to open investments into the global industries and the development of mineral fields. Of course, the priority is given to our American partners. But the second important part is that we want this agreement to be perfect from the legal point of view, so that this is beneficial both to the investor and to Ukraine. But there is another component which the Ukrainian president insists upon. We want to have economic gains from the cooperation in extraction of rare earth minerals. And we also want to get security guarantees. We want the security guarantor to be named in the treaty. The two presidents of Ukraine and of the USA would have to sign this agreement in the end. So the preparation work is going on, and this process will take a certain amount of time.
If no deal emerges in the coming weeks and months that's satisfactory from Ukraine's point of view, can you carry on fighting this war, even if you have to do so without American support?
So far, I don't see such a scenario. If the United States refuses to support Ukraine, it will be a demoralizing factor for the whole of Europe, and it will harm the reputation of the United States. So I don't see this scenario as beneficial to the US itself. But let's talk about what Ukraine is going to do. We understand that Russia is not coming here to create good conditions. It's occupation, and they're coming here to carry out mass killings. They've been demonstrating this for the last 11 years, starting in 2014. So we have to continue resisting them. We understand what we need to do. But the key issue is that we have to continue cooperation with America and explain to them why it's more beneficial for America to not tolerate Russia and to support European unity and Ukraine. So, of course, we will continue to resist, and our British and our French friends are going to support us.
Mykhailo Podolyak, a senior aide to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He was speaking there to Weekend's Julian Warriker. In the past hour, President Zelensky has said that he hopes for a what he calls a fair minerals agreement with the US. And President Trump has said that Volodymyr Zelensky and Vladimir Putin, quote, must speak. All the latest is appearing on our live page on our website, bbc.com/news. That's all for this edition of NewsHour. For a Friday evening UK time, thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.
Some of the world's driest places, people are harvesting water from thin air using giant nets to trap fog. research from Chile has found that this method could meet an entire city's water demands. I'm Hannah Gelbart. Join me on What in the World to hear how fog catching works and if it could help solve global water shortages. What in the World is a daily podcast from the BBC World Service. We cover news and trending topics every weekday in less than 15 minutes. You can find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.